This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. It's been 322 days since Hurricane Maria made landfall on the island of Puerto Rico. It's been a long and arduous process to rebuild homes, to restock shelves, and to turn the lights back on. But one controversial part of the island's strategy for recovery, the rush to privatize public services.
Deseo informarte.
I wish to inform you of one of the initiatives that will have the greatest impact for the construction of a new and modern Puerto Rico. During the next few days, we will begin the process to sell the shares of the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority to companies, which will transform the energy system to one that is modern, efficient, and less costly for the people.
That's Puerto Rico's Governor Ricardo Rosselló addressing the privatization of the electrical grid in January. A month later, in February, changes to Puerto Rico's education system were also announced.
We will begin implementing the Alliance Schools, known in some jurisdictions as charter schools.
And now new reporting reveals plans for the island's corrections department to outsource some of its operations to a private prison company, thousands of miles away on the United States mainland. One-third of the island's prison population, or around 3,200 inmates, could be sent to the U.S. mainland in 2019 through contracts with the private prison company Core Civic. Oliver Lachlan is a senior reporter with The Guardian, and he traveled to Bayamón, Puerto Rico in July to find out more about the island's plans to move inmates out. Oliver, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you visited the Puerto Rico prison system. Give us a sense of what the conditions are in Bayamón, the facilities that you've seen, and just the big picture there.
So I visited the Bayamón Correctional Complex back in July. It's one of the biggest correctional complexes on the island. There's about 1,700 inmates there. I would describe the conditions there as being pretty old. So a number of the wings that I visited were using sort of paper cards to keep tabs on the inmates. There weren't computers being used, that sort of thing. And this is part of the justification that the corrections department offer to say that, you know, we have an old kind of crumbling prison system that needs updating, that we need to look after our inmates better. And so this is the solution they're putting out there. A huge part of it is about cost cutting as well. And so they're planning to start sending inmates over the beginning of 2019, and it will be 1,200 to start off with, and then in batches of 700 for the next 3 years.
So when you went down to Puerto Rico, you met with Eric Rolón, who's the secretary of the Puerto Rico Corrections and Rehabilitation Department. And let's take a listen to the reason he gave for the plan.
Due to the economic situation that we have in the government, for us, it's an initiative that represents a very cost-effective way to provide our service.
So he's focusing on cost. Tell us what you think about that, Oliver.
Well, yeah, exactly. So that's the justification that he gave. They hope that this plan is going to save about $45 million a year. And the Corrections Department has been instructed by the Fiscal Oversight Board, which is an elected control board that basically dictates Puerto Rico's economic affairs, to save hundreds of million dollars over the next 5 years. When I was there, a lot of the people I spoke to spoke about the sort of concerns around cost as being a secondary issue to inmate well-being. And a lot of the inmates that I spoke to were very concerned about the idea of being forced into these transfers. Civil liberties groups say that even if the corrections secretary, as he does, says that these will be voluntary transfers, there's not really such thing as a voluntary agreement you can enter into when you're a ward of the state.
And I want to get into more of those details in a second, because one of the pieces in your piece showed that one prisoner said that thousands of prisoners are against this move. Is that right?
Yeah, so one of the sort of key cultural underpinnings of the Puerto Rico prison system is gang culture. And when we were there, we were led into a medium security wing in the Bayamón Correctional Facility that was stratified. There were five wards that were stratified by gang affiliation. So we were led into one that was run by a group called Asociación Nieta, which is the largest prison association in the country. It was formed in the late 1970s, has connections to the independence movement. And a number of reviews have sort of found that it operates basically a shadow system of government. They say they have 6,000 members all across the island inside prison. That's obviously two-thirds of the entire prison population. And this guy that I spoke to, who numerous prison officials told me was speaking as a spokesman for this association, which has a very rigid power structure, said that the entire association is opposed to this move.
We're talking about the outsourcing of Puerto Rican inmates to private prisons on the mainland, and I'm speaking with Oliver Lachlan from The Guardian. Tell us a little bit about the contract. So Puerto Rico Department of Corrections is signing a contract with Core Civic. And we've heard here in the United States a lot about Core Civic. They run private ICE detention centers. Tell us more about who they are.
So Core Civic are one of the largest private prison contractors in the country. It's been quite difficult to try and get real details about the contract itself. Corrections Secretary Hollande, it hasn't actually been signed yet, so that's a major point. It's got to be approved by the Oversight Board. He's told me that it's 99% there, and that was a few weeks ago, and yesterday they said they're going to sign it in the next few days. CoreCivic haven't been particularly forthcoming about, you know, how much this contract is going to be worth, the period of time that they're going to sign it for and that sort of thing. But we know the facility that they're aiming to use, so it's the La Palma Detention Center in Eloy, Arizona, which is obviously thousands of miles away from Puerto Rico. It has been used in the past by the state government of California to hold inmates on an out-of-state program. There have been a whole raft of issues associated with the conditions there. 2010 audit identified numerous issues with security and safety concerns, the overuse of solitary confinement, and that really is part of a broader trend of the way in which private prisons operate in this country. In 2016, the Obama administration published a review of the use of private prisons in the federal incarceration system, which basically found across the board that they were less safe and more punitive than those operated by the public.
So obviously, civil rights advocates have many concerns about moving these prisoners. And among them, I'm wondering, you not only separate the prisoners from their family, but you also separate them from their attorneys and any other, you know, legal help that they might be able to access. What are some of the other concerns that civil rights advocates have? You mentioned prisoners in many cases are ward of the state, which would indicate that they really can't make a decision to voluntarily leave this prison, right?
Yeah, well, that's what the ACLU of Puerto Rico say. They basically said this is state-sponsored human trafficking, which is quite an eye-grabbing way of describing what's going on. I think there are, aside from the issues of consent, which is obviously a major one, and the Corrections Secretary has absolutely insisted that this will be a voluntary program, and that even though they're going to be contracted to send over a certain number of inmates, they will only be voluntary people who decide to go for it.
But see, but that right there doesn't make sense, right? There's a contract for X thousand number of people, and then all those people are going to be voluntary. So if nobody volunteers, then what happens?
Well, so he told me when I interviewed him a few weeks ago that they'd had 1,200 expressions of interest. That was the phrase that he used. So they'd surveyed the entire inmate population of 9,000 people. 1,200 people said they were interested in doing it. It transpired that they had been briefed on the wrong prisons at that point. So they had briefed them on prisons in Texas and in Mississippi, which are no longer being considered. They then revised the number down to about 850, but wouldn't tell me why. So yeah, it's perplexing. I don't exactly understand what an expression of interest means, but there's an insistence that this will be voluntary, and I guess we kind of have to wait and see how that'll play out.
When you were in Puerto Rico, you spoke to an inmate, and his name was Josep Villalobos, and he's in the Bayamón facility. Let's listen to what he had to say.
My mom, my sister, my three kids are here. So if it's voluntarily, I'd rather stay here. Because here I can work.
Yeah.
I got, you know, everything is developed for me. I really don't want to go.
Yeah.
But once you're in jail and you got that sentence on you, they dictate the rules, you know.
Yeah.
If the COs come and say, hey, pick up your things, okay, you're leaving, I will make no no movement. I pick up my things and I go. Because for you to go home as quickly as you can, you gotta obey by the rules.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Josep.
So Josep kind of, to me, underlined a lot of the concerns that inmates that I spoke to had about this program. So he was in there, he was serving a 26-year sentence for a felony offense. He didn't go into too much detail about what it was about. He said it was a non-violent felony offense. He was 7 years in, and he had served about 4 or 5 years on a high-security wing, so he was on 22-hour lockdowns a day. He graduated through the rehabilitative process that is basically mandated by the Puerto Rican Constitution. So he was now out in the minimum security wing. And really, when he spoke to me, it kind of underlined to me this very palpable sense of unease that a lot of inmates that I spoke to exuded the whole time, which was, you know, we've been told this is voluntary. None of us want to go. So I didn't meet a single inmate that said they wanted to go. But we are aware that we're essentially powerless in this situation. And if we're told we have to, then we'll do it because we want to get out.
Has this been attempted in the past, anything to this scale or the removal of prisoners at this level?
So Puerto Rico has attempted to offshore inmates on two previous occasions. So in 1993, when there was chronic overcrowding in the entire prison system on the island, the government sanctioned the move of 500 inmates to a rural facility in Minnesota. And that program lasted about a couple of years. And there were sort of numerous complaints about the food that was on offer, the fact that all the guards spoke English and didn't speak Spanish, lack of educational programs. So eventually that program was mothballed. All the inmates were moved back to the island. Again, in 2012, they tried to ship a bunch of inmates to Cushing in Oklahoma. There was a riot that ensued. It was the same number of people, so about 480 people, a riot that ensued, and they had to end that one too. So I asked Corrections Secretary Rollon about this, and his answer was kind of perplexing. He basically said to me, we understand this has failed in the past, but we think that because this is a more ambitious program that we're going to try and transfer more people, it will somehow magically work.
So we did reach out to both the Puerto Rico state government and to CoreCivic. And by the time we're broadcasting, the Puerto Rican government has not yet responded to our request for comment. But CoreCivic did send along a comment, and I want to read it for you. And for our listeners, you can read the entirety of their comment on our website. But let me read this for you. CoreCivic is committed to the safety and dignity of every individual entrusted to our care. It's unfortunate that The Guardian chose to sensationalize the very real challenges Puerto Rico is facing rather than fostering a serious, fact-based discussion on how those challenges might be addressed. The fact is that CoreCivic helps our government partners solve problems in ways they simply could not do alone. Your response?
Well, first of all, I would say I work for The Guardian. We take facts very, very seriously, and facts are sacred. That's what we say. I also approached CoreCivic a number of weeks ago with 8 very specific questions about the contract, about exactly how it's going to be managed. And they came out with a very generic response, which is included in my article.
They also added that they follow all the legal requirements for running private prisons. So I guess the question is, how would you respond to that if they say we're going to take care of everything and there's no reason for concern?
Well, I guess if you just look at the use of the La Palma facility over the past years that it's been used by the state of California, there have been chronic issues that have been identified in audit reports, which I've mentioned earlier, but I'll go back to them again. It's issues about overuse of solitary confinement, not providing enough programs for Hispanic inmates, which I think is an incredibly important thing to raise at this point, not allowing for proper video conferencing with families, which again is going to be a major issue. This is a 2010 report, but later audits have also spoken about poor healthcare facilities in the prison. So I guess, you know, when Roland talks about oversight and ensuring the constitutional rights of these prisoners, we really need to know exactly how the audit process is going to work with the Puerto Rican government as well.
Oliver Lachland is a senior reporter with The Guardian. Oliver, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And The Guardian is doing a 3-day series on this and other issues in Puerto Rico, and we'll link to it on thetakeaway.org. Last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions convened a group of religious leaders to announce the creation of a religious liberty task force.
A dangerous movement, undetected by many, but real, is now challenging and eroding a great tradition of religious freedom. There can be no doubt. It's no little matter. It must be confronted intellectually and politically and defeated.
Sessions mentioned certain cases that he said raised red flags, cases like the Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, and a group of nuns who didn't want to cover birth control in their employees' health care at a nursing home. Groups like the ACLU feared the task force would serve as another tool to prioritize religious rights over civil liberties. Here's Daniel Mack, and he directs the ACLU Freedom of Religion and Belief Program.
The Justice Department's task force could open the door to widespread discrimination in employment and government-funded services against LGBTQ people, women seeking health care, and religious minorities.
And a week after the task force was announced, there are still questions about what exactly this group is designed to do. Beth Williams is the co-vice chair of the Justice Department's task force and an assistant attorney general for the DOJ's Office of Legal Policy. And I asked her why the Justice Department felt the need to address this issue now.
It's been more than 20 years since President Clinton issued his guidelines on religious exercise and religious expression in the federal workplace. And, you know, I think it's really just a time to reevaluate how we're doing. You know, the Clinton guidelines explain that the federal government has to accommodate people of practicing faith. What those guidelines said was that you can keep a Quran or a Bible on your desk and you can discuss your faith with fellow employees. So in many ways, what our Justice Department is doing is just taking stock of where we are and making sure that religious liberty continues to be protected.
Now, does the task force have any actual authority or any powers over implementing, I guess, how people are able to discuss their religion? Or what exactly will the task force do?
Well, the task force really has two parts, and it's primarily a coordinating body, and it's a way for the Department of Justice to take stock of what we're currently doing and really take a look at what else, if anything, needs to be done to protect religious liberty.
Now, we know that when it comes to the protection of certain civil rights, there are actions that the federal government can take. How will you, as the co-chair of this task force, sort of determine what issues you want to prioritize or the task force wants to prioritize and what is really going to be at the top of the agenda?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, with any coordinating body, one of the first steps that you do is you solicit feedback from diverse perspectives. You try to talk to people and see, you know, what are the problems and what can be done to help. When this department put out the religious liberty guidance, when the Attorney General did that, he convened a series of listening sessions with various groups, the ACLU, the Anti-Defamation League, various different religious groups, to talk to them about their experiences and see how things were going.
Now, this task force, of course, was met with criticism, as I'm sure you're well aware. It's been said that given the administration's tone so far, that this is really another way to strengthen right-wing Christian groups and discriminate against LGBTQ people or other groups in the United States. What do you say to that?
You know, I think that that's really concerning. It's too bad that people, you know, have felt that this is going to be a way to discriminate, because that is the exact opposite of the purpose of the task force. I want to emphasize that there's absolutely no animus against any group that is driving this initiative. Religious liberty and civil rights are not mutually exclusive. And the goal of this is to show that, except in the narrowest circumstances, no one should be forced to choose between living out his or her faith and complying with the law. And that's what this is about.
Well, there's a case that the Supreme Court decided recently. It was the case of Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado. And Jack was at the summit.
I serve everybody who comes in my shop. In fact, the two men that came in my shop that sued me, you know, I offered to, you know, sell them anything in my shop. I'll make you birthday cakes, other custom work. Doesn't matter what your orientation is, it's just that I can't do this cake.
Was this anything that sort of helped to formalize this task force? Was this sort of a green light that said, you know what, now it's the time for us to create something a little bit more formal, given this case and the direction that this case is pointing in?
No, there was no one case that really prompted this task force. This task force is just about coordinating religious liberty efforts more generally. I mean, the Department of Justice prosecutes and handles a number of cases in this area. You know, just last month, a jury convicted a Texas man of a hate crime in the burning of a mosque, and our civil rights division was proud and to prosecute that case and put that person in jail. And we've also brought civil suits against different towns who have denied zoning approval for Orthodox Jewish houses of worship. You know, there are a lot of cases of religious liberty and religious freedom in this country that need to be looked at. Obviously, not every case is going to have the support of the Department of Justice, but one of the things we need to do is evaluate the cases and take a look at them and see if religious liberty is in jeopardy.
You mentioned some of the examples that I was going to raise, actually, was the increasing rates of discrimination against Muslim groups. There have also been anti-Semitic cases that we're seeing, whether it's graffiti or destroying a property. So there is a lot of religious animus that we're seeing in the United States today. Can these communities, regardless of their faith, really count on the Department of Justice to protect them?
Absolutely. And I think that's what you've seen in the first year and a half of this department. This department is prosecuting strongly anybody who commits a hate crime against people of faith. And whether that be Muslim or Jewish or Christian or Sikh or other faiths, this Department of Justice takes that very seriously. It's a topic of great concern, and I think it should be.
So there was another group that was at the summit, and this was the Alliance Defending Freedom. And this group has been roundly criticized for having extreme views against the LGBTQ community. The Southern Poverty Law Center has them on their list of extremist groups. What message are we to take away from the fact that they were at this task force? I mean, is that a signal that the goals of the Justice Department are in line with the Alliance Defending Freedom?
I think you saw a lot of different groups at that task force. You saw ADF, but you also saw Sikhs, you saw Catholics, Jewish, Muslim representatives. The summit was, the goal of the summit was to highlight religious liberty and why it matters. The department doesn't take sides with any one group and everything that they do. The goal was to bring people of different faiths together to discuss religious liberty issues.
Beth Williams is the Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice and the co-vice chair of the Religious Liberty Task Force. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Week two continues in the trial of President Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort, who's facing federal charges on bank fraud and tax fraud. And former Trump campaign liaison and Manafort associate Rick Gates has been on the stand. Earlier this year, Gates struck a plea deal with Robert Mueller in exchange for his testimony against Manafort. Ilya Marantz is a WNYC reporter and co-host of the Trumping podcast. He was down in Alexandria, Virginia this week in the courtroom for Gates' testimony, and he joins me now in studio. Hey, Ilya.
Hi, Tanzina.
Let's get right to it because this is like a soap opera. What is the main takeaway here today?
Yeah, I mean, this was such an important day for both prosecution and defense. This is the key witness. They both have a huge amount riding on this testimony. For prosecutors, it's their chance to explain just what Paul Manafort was doing, setting up these offshore companies and offshore bank accounts and pulling money that he was paid in Ukraine into those accounts and then eventually into the United States in some cases. And Rick Gates is uniquely positioned to do that explaining because he was at Paul Manafort's side. He was his right-hand man for 8 or 9 years, almost the whole time that Manafort was active in Ukraine. What's more, his particular area of responsibility, as he testified, was those bank accounts. So Gates said he paid Manafort's bills from secret offshore accounts and kept those payments secret from his bookkeeper at Paul Manafort's direction. He also testified that when Manafort's Ukrainian client, President Viktor Yanukovych, was driven from power, Paul Manafort's financial situation quickly deteriorated to the point where he was desperately going around to borrow money and in some cases falsifying statements about his income so he could get loans from banks. Again, all with Paul Manafort's knowledge and approval. That's what prosecutors were saying yesterday. On the defense side, this is their chance to dent Rick Gates' credibility so that the jury doesn't know whether to trust anything that he says. And secondarily, they can also try to create their own alternative storyline about what was really going on. What defense lawyers have said is that Paul Manafort trusted the wrong man. Yeah, he might have checked some wrong boxes on his tax returns, but he trusted the wrong guy.
Even though he was doing things that were wrong to begin with.
Paul Manafort was primarily a political consultant and a businessman, and the person who he hired to look after those bank accounts was making these bad, illegal decisions. It was Gates who had authority over those accounts, and defense did manage to land some body blows on Gates. They got Gates to concede that he stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from Paul Manafort. If Paul Manafort knew it, he didn't do anything about it. So that indicates that Gates was more active with the accounts at some times, at least, than Paul Manafort was. They also got him to concede an extramarital affair. And
an apartment associated with that, right? I think in London or
exactly.
Something.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they raised the question of insider trading, which Gates denied. So although he kept a calm demeanor throughout, they did raise some pretty serious questions about his behavior.
And one of the other things that Gates testified was that Manafort was paid $4 million a year to help, you mentioned, Viktor Yanukovych. Now, why was that information important?
Well, obviously it's big money, but it also indicates that Paul Manafort wasn't just in Ukraine to write speeches and run elections. He was there doing political consulting once Viktor Yanukovych came to power in 2010. He was doing foreign lobbying to the U.S. and to European countries and the IMF. He dabbled in private equity. So really just trying to make business doing business. The dollar amount legally doesn't matter as much as the fact that Manafort and Gates allegedly had these overseas bank accounts and overseas income and did not declare them. But it helps us understand what happened next when Manafort was in financial straits and allegedly lied to these banks to get bank loans.
So you mentioned Gates' credibility, and both the prosecution and the defense are relying on that credibility. Did you get any sense of how the jury has been impacting? You were in the courtroom.
It's really hard to tell. I mean, they're listening very attentively. I didn't notice anybody nodding off or anything like that. There were sections where you could nod off because they are being run through an enormous number of exhibits, contracts between shell companies, names of oligarchs that they, or businessmen for the purposes of this trial, Judge Ellis doesn't like the term oligarchs, names of rich Ukrainian businessmen that may be unfamiliar. So the question is partly, is this all adding up for the jury? Are they able to discern a story from the many, many records that they have to review.
And you mentioned the judge, a little bit of a colorful figure, no?
Yes, absolutely. Judge Ellis wants to keep the trial moving. He, in general, has had a lot of clashes with the prosecution team. At one point, I watched him instruct Greg Andres, one of the special counsel's team, on how he should ask his question. On the other side, with the defense team, he sort of seemed to help them at times question Rick Gates and make Rick Gates squirm. I think his final, almost the final thing he said as they were wrapping up on Tuesday was, well, you know, why should anybody believe you, Rick Gates? You admitted that you stole from your employer, Paul Manafort. So I don't know how that's going to play with the jury.
Tell us a little bit about Manafort in the courtroom when you watched him. What was his reaction, if any, to what Rick Gates's testimony?
The first thing I wrote in my notebook when I got there was, does not look gaunt. You sort of expect somebody who's been in prison to look like they've had a rough time. But he's in, you know, a charcoal suit. His hair is getting very bushy and gray. It used to be sort of like a rich brown. But he would you know, hold his fingertips together and just sort of watch the proceedings very calmly, sometimes put on reading glasses, review documents. He didn't betray any emotion.
Now, we did learn a new name during Gates's testimony, Viktor Pinchuk. Who's that?
Viktor Pinchuk is a steel magnate in Ukraine. He has been a top businessman there for over a decade. He's the son-in-law of the former president, Leonid Kuchma. And he's actually a very interesting figure to Robert Mueller, because in the fall of 2015, Viktor Pinchuk's foundation paid Donald Trump's foundation $150,000 for a speech that Donald Trump gave to a conference in Ukraine. That was while Trump was a declared candidate for president. I think he was considered very much of a long shot at the time, but that is when that happened. And that is reportedly a donation of interest to Robert Mueller.
And what happens next?
What happens next? Well, Gates is testifying again today. The prosecution team has about 15 more witnesses on their list. They say they won't call them all, and they hope to end their questioning this week. Excuse me. Judge Ellis really wants this to move fast, as I mentioned. We don't know how quickly a jury could return a verdict, of course. Whatever the verdict, Manafort will be due back in court in mid-September on the bulk of the charges. Remember, this is a split trial where the tax and bank fraud is the first part. Then there's conspiracy against the United States and failure to register as a foreign agent.
Ilya Marritz is a WNYC reporter and co-host of the Trumping podcast. Thanks, Ilya.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to The Takeaway. We say it a lot, but we really mean it. Our listeners are the most important part of our show. We want to hear from you. Jump into the discussion on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. And keep listening. Thanks again.
In Michigan on Tuesday, voters had the chance to cast their ballots for four Muslim Americans in different state and federal races. It's part of a wave of Muslim Americans running for office. And here to talk about how they fared and the state of Muslim Americans in politics more broadly is Hamza Khan. He's the executive director of the Pluralism Project, a political organization that supports diverse candidates, including many Muslim Americans. Hamza, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Rashida Tlaib, who won the Democratic primary for the 13th district that covers part of Detroit and the suburbs. And she'll be running uncontested in November for former Representative John Conyers' seat after he resigned this winter after accusations of sexual harassment. Tell us about her.
Rashida is a very interesting candidate. She's a former state elected official herself, and she's been running on a very, very progressive platform. And what's really interesting about her race is that the coalition she put together of donors, activists, politicos from across the country really mimic what we're seeing across the nation in terms of a new generation of immigrant female candidates who are emerging and winning. They're very progressive. They lean towards more of the left of the party, and they're very well funded. They're able to put together a strong finance platform. And what's really great about Rashida is that, as I recall, she raised the most amount of money in her race, even though she was running against several candidates with a lot of name recognition and a lot of establishment support. And on top of that, she did face a little bit of a backlash from dark money groups who went after her and attacked her record and tried to paint her in a negative light. But she kept the course, and she was able to put together a coalition that delivered her victory last night.
So there were about 100 Muslim Americans running in state, local, and federal elections this year. And one group that tracks this says that that's the most Muslim Americans that they've seen running for office in at least a decade. So what's driving this?
That's definitely true. And there are likely more than 100 candidates who are running across the country. Here in Maryland, the Pluralism Project helped organize over 30 Muslim candidates to run for various state, local offices and federal offices. And what was interesting to see that is that even though a lot of these candidates didn't make it through the first time, there is a genuine interest and a genuine sense of camaraderie between these various communities to get out there and be a part of the democratic process in a way that hasn't been seen before. Up until now, we've seen a decrease in the overall turnout in Democratic primaries nationwide and Republican primaries, actually. This time around, we're seeing a new resurgence of a new group of Democrats, a new coalition, a broader coalition that includes immigrants, it includes Muslim Americans, and is very much a part of the millennial wave, in one way of putting it, is that we have so many millennials who are getting involved in the political process for the first time, and they're taking ownership of the future of America.
Now, obviously, we're living in a very politicized moment, a very stressful moment, if you will, in our country. And I'm wondering if there is an increased risk that these Muslim American men and women take when they put themselves out to run for office. And I'm talking about explicitly racism, xenophobia, anti-Islamic sentiment, etc.
There has definitely been an uptick since the election of Donald Trump in Islamophobic incidents across the country. And those incidences have obviously impacted the campaigns of countless Muslim American candidates across the United States. But that is a part of the American experience, unfortunately, where we see immigrant candidates, where we see minority candidates and new interest groups, so to speak, new demographics in America. When they try to get involved in the political process, there is a backlash from those who are a part of the status quo, from those who are already entrenched and established. And that is within Democratic primaries as well. It's not simply fair to put out a generalization and claim that this is something we see largely on the right. There are plenty of liberal and secular activists who also respond in this way towards the rise of new communities and political circles. So that being said, this is just the beginning of the road for Muslim American candidates and for Muslim Americans in the political process. I think that we're going to be seeing more and more Muslims run for office as a result of the success we've seen just recently with Rashida's race in Michigan. And also, you know, to point out Abdul Saeed and Firuz Saad, who both ran as well in Michigan, did not win, but had a great deal of momentum behind them and have inspired a new generation of activists to go forward. I don't think that anyone should be surprised that there was a backlash this time around, but the future is bright for us as a community and as Americans.
Hamza Khan is the head of the Pluralism Project. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
This weekend marks a year since white nationalists descended on Charlottesville, Virginia for the Unite the Right rally. We covered some of the fallout from that on Monday's show with ProPublica's A.C. Thompson.
There was what appears to have been basically a conscious decision on the part of Charlottesville police to allow violence to occur in the streets and let that violence happen and then declare an unlawful assembly and say, hey, we're going to clear everyone out. And that violence absolutely spiraled out of control. And I think we can say clearly, a year later, that was a really, really bad decision.
But Charlottesville denied the group a permit to hold a second rally this year, and now Unite the Right is taking its message to our nation's capital. Organizer Jason Kessler got initial approval to hold the event in Washington, D.C.'s Lafayette Square, right in front of the White House, from the National Park Service earlier this year. And the service hasn't issued a final permit yet, but the city is already preparing for what will likely be a tense weekend. So we're turning to some D.C. voices now. Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt is a senior rabbi at Addis Israel Congregation in D.C., and Mark Lance is an activist and professor of philosophy, justice, and peace at Georgetown University. Mark, Rabbi, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Mark, let's start with you. You've been involved in a bunch of activist groups in Washington for a while. Can you walk us through some of the response that you've seen once the Unite the Right rally, once people found out that this rally was coming to Washington?
Absolutely. So first, just to be clear, this is the group that invaded Charlottesville with guns and torches under the banner of expelling Jews, blacks, LGBT folks, immigrants, Muslims from our country. And now they're coming to one of the most diverse, progressive, and black cities in America with the same message. We want to show that this entire city is coming together to say this is not a debatable issue of public policy. This is people spreading the most hateful, the most violent ideology in the history of humanity and bringing it into our city, and we're not going to tolerate that.
Rabbi, we just heard Mark use the word Nazi, and the ideology of these white nationalists is one that directly threatens your congregation, particularly with the use of that word. What's the feeling among the Jewish community in Washington, D.C. right now?
I think the mood is both. There are people who are anxious for sure. The mood is also tired, but resilient. I think over the last year, we've felt like there's been a real amplification of hate in this country. And certainly from Charlottesville last year, there were many synagogues that were targeted when this group invaded the city. And so we've both been dealing with that anxiousness by beefing up security for the weekend in our own building and obviously in synagogues around the city, but also really trying to stay grounded in our values of love and tzedek, justice, and inviting our partners from all different faiths, from the LGBTQ community, from folks that are brown and black and part of every community in this city to join us in our worship this weekend in our synagogue.
I want to ask both of you, we obviously opened the segment talking about Charlottesville and the way that Charlottesville unraveled last year was unfortunately in violence and in death. And the potential for violence at a rally like this with counter-protesters seems pretty high. What are your thoughts, Mark?
Well, one thing I would say is that the D.C. capacity for policing is very different than Charlottesville, so I expect the state to have a different role than it did there. But beyond that, we've been focusing very carefully and with a great deal of detail on security. At our rally, we will have security in many forms around the perimeter, around the stage, moving through the crowd, looking for anyone who's trying to start violence. We'll have a liaison to the police, even though our hope is to handle this internally. But there's always a possibility. I mean, it's Nazis, right? I mean, they are coming, not disavowing a person who drove a car into a crowd trying to murder multiple people and succeeding in murdering one. They're celebrating the successes of Charlottesville. That's their words. So we're clear about who we're dealing with, and there's potential there, and there's many of us who are willing to put our bodies between them and the most vulnerable people in the city, if it comes to that.
And this has gone from something that I think a lot of Americans would rather have forgotten about or would like to consider fringe. But Rabbi, as a faith leader, how do you see the trajectory of this white nationalist movement as it's continued to grow? We're seeing anti-Semitic hate crimes on the rise, anti-Muslim, anti-Latino crimes. I mean, do you see this as a growing movement, or is this just the willingness of some people to be more open about what they really feel?
My sense is there's been an amplification of hate amongst the highest offices of this country. And I think when you have rhetoric and policies that push for fear of the stranger within national policy, I think what it does is it ignites dormant groups that are out there and allows them to feel that they have center stage. And look, I feel as a religious leader that our job is to do the same, is to amplify our voice of love and peace and unity and a dignity of difference that is so, we feel it so beautifully in the city of Washington, and that it's our job actually to be a counter voice, to be a voice that actually says, this is not who we are as a country. This is not who we are as a religious community. And we need to stand grounded in our principles and our values.
And yet we are seeing not just rhetoric, but policies like things like, quote unquote, zero tolerance. Mark, what is your sense of how or is white nationalism winning in some ways now that we're seeing it not just with this march, but in bigger policy initiatives?
It's growing for sure. And with the immigration policies, the Muslim policies of the government, as well as from some people, dog whistles in support of actual neo-Nazis, and in the case of some people in the White House, direct support. It's also worth emphasizing that this nationalist movement is a worldwide phenomenon. We've seen right-wing governments arising in Turkey, in Hungary, in Poland, in Austria. In countries around the world, there's a resurgence of this most hateful of ideologies. At the same time, it's brought thousands and thousands of good people who haven't necessarily been involved politically beyond voting out into the streets. I'm seeing colleagues from my university who, good people, but not people who are organizers and activists, calling me and asking what to do. So there's a response coming. So I'm not going to say they're winning because they're not going to win. We're going to all stop them.
Right. And I want to follow up on that with the rabbi. I think a lot of people feel hopeless sometimes, so they feel frustrated. You mentioned people being tired. Do you have a message for people who are seeing this and feeling like we should have gotten past this and here we are and there's a sense of hopelessness and or fear?
Yes, absolutely. I think it has to do with a lot with what Mark just said, which is I think one of the things that we've seen amongst this time, even though we are tired and tired of dealing with this, is an activism that maybe had been not as present over the past several years. And I think one of the things to remember is the moral arc of the world will bend towards justice. And I think part of our job as a community is to come together and remind each other of that and build our voices to be a presence within the world continually on an ongoing basis.
Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt is senior rabbi at Addis Israel Congregation in D.C., and Mark Lance is a professor at Georgetown University. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Has your community changed since last year's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville? For good or for bad, have you seen more inclusion and activism? Or have you noticed an increase in hate or white supremacist activity? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us what you think. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.